Welcome to the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, episode number 50. I survive because the fire inside of me burns brighter than the fire around me. Anonymous.
This is the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, where we teach you the top strategies, tactics, and growth hacks that every indie filmmaker needs to know to make money with their films. We are the podcast that puts the business back into show business. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Filmtrepreneur Podcast. I am your humble and quarantined host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films. From predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them, the odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Before we get started, guys, I set up a special link to help people affected by the coronavirus, and you can donate to Feed America. There is a lot of people in need out there, and Feed America is a great organization, and they're helping millions of people on a daily basis, and they also need your help. If you want to donate, even $5, $10, it goes a long way. Head over to indiefilmhustle.com/help. Well, guys, we have made it episode number 50. Thank you guys so much for all the support. Thank you for everybody who's read the book, purchased the book, left reviews for the book. If you have read Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, please leave a review on Amazon or Audible or both. It really helps get this information out more to more and more filmmakers. So thank you guys so much. And I can't wait to do more and more amazing content for you guys in the coming weeks and months. And I am in the lab working on that ever requested item, the Filmtrepreneur online course. So I am working on that. It will follow up my next course, which will be Film Distribution Confidential, which will be talking all about traditional distribution and how not to get screwed over by a predatory film distributor. And you can sign up for early access to that course at ifhacademy.com. So today, guys, I wanted to talk about a project I did many moons ago, and I learned a tremendous amount of lessons. It's actually one of the most valuable projects I ever did in regards to lessons and what I learned from it and how not to do things. Now, as the title of the podcast suggests, how not to shoot a $50,000 short film. Now, you must be asking yourselves, Alex, where the hell did you get 50 grand? Well, mistake number one is I invested $50,000 from my savings that I had been saving over the course of years. But before I get into all of that, I'm going to go back to the beginning, and I'm going to talk to you guys a little bit about how the project came to be, what happened to it, my journeys through Hollywood, meetings, things like that, and where it is today. So the project I wrote a screenplay, a few years ago now, called Red Prince's Blues. And, I wrote a full screenplay because when I went through this the first time with my short film Broken, where I got a lot of press and got into a bunch of festivals and did the tours, got studios calling me, producers calling me about the movie, I had nothing ready. So I said to myself, well, if I can make a cool short film again, get a bunch of attention, but I'll have a screenplay ready and it'll be ready to go. So when I do those meetings, I'll have that screenplay and I can pop it up and I'm off to the races. And that was the theory. So when I started doing, when I went after creating Red Prince's Blues, that was my first main focus, was to create a calling card for not only myself as a director, but also for the project and hopefully getting the project off the ground. So after doing Broken, I did, you know, I wanted to take everything up a notch. I wanted to get some name actors, or at least faces, some really accomplished actors that I can work with. And I was blessed to have working with Robert Forster, an Academy Award nominee from Jackie Brown, Tarantino's Jackie Brown. He's a legend, a legendary actor who worked with us on the project. As of course, Richard Tyson from Kindergarten Cop fame from back in the 80s. And he's always working, and he's a very established actor as well. And Rachel Grant, who is a Bond girl from one of Pierce Brosnan's James Bond movies back in the day as well. So these were all established actors and experienced actors. And I wanted to just take everything up a notch from what I did before. So I wanted to create a world and create this environment, which is a really seedy, carny, you know, carnival folk, you know, backstage after a carnival, you know, hookers and prostitutes and drinking and all sorts of debauchery going on. And I had never seen anything like that on screen before. So I was like, well, let me see if I can kind of create this world. So not only did I have, you know, the most experienced actors I'd ever worked with at that point in my career in front of the lens, I needed to have an insane team on the back behind the scenes as well. So I was able to work with a production designer from 24, the show 24, who was amazing. And he was able to create these crazy sets. And I'll tell you a little story about where we got the sets in a bunch of the sets in the first place. But we also was also able to work with a stunt coordinator. His name is Jeff Caliente, who was the stunt coordinator on 24. He was on The Crow. He was on Scarface. I mean, he'd been around for a while, but he was the head stunt coordinator on 24 and now has been the stunt coordinator on Hawaii 5-0 for the last six, seven years that he's been on that as well. So he was able to gather a bunch of amazing stunt performers to come and work with us on this little action short. And again, the quality of people I was working with was pretty much top of the industry. I mean, people were coming from Kill Bill, The Matrix, insane credits. We're all coming to work on my little short film that I was shooting here in North Hollywood, for God's sakes. So these guys were coming up and helping me work on this stuff. I had a great DP who, you know, very seasoned DP that I worked with as well. And we were pulling favors left and right. You can imagine, like, it cost 50 grand, but yet I got a lot of stuff gratis. I got a lot of stuff donated or helped or pulled favors or exchanged services, all sorts of stuff like that. So I had a really top end team. And when you see the short, you'll see that it was well put together. I mean, and I'm not being cocky, but on a professional standpoint, the production value was fairly high on it, without question, because I had amazing talent working behind the scenes. So we built this insane set that, you know, we were able to, since 24 was just shutting down, my production designer basically went over to the 24 warehouse and just grabbed a bunch of flats, which are basic walls, pre-done walls that had graffiti on them and had, brick on them. So we were able to create the outside of a carnival inside of a soundstage. So we were able to do that. We went to their prop warehouse and basically just took a shopping cart and grabbed whatever we needed for free. This was all for free, guys. I mean, so even with all of that, you'll ask where did all this money go to? And I'll tell you in a minute. So we were able to build this really awesome short, and I'm very, very proud of it. And I'm going to just step back for a second. This is the second Red Princess Blue short. The first one was a Japanese anime that I co-directed with my brother-in-arms, Dan Cregan, who was the animator on it. And I try to create kind of like a prequel story to the short film, to the screenplay, trying to get attention that way. So not only had one short, I had two really high-end shorts that I'm using to promote and try to get this project off the ground. So what's the first lesson I learned? I'll finish up where this short went. We made the short. It got into probably, I don't know, 60, 70, 80 film festivals. I didn't keep going with it. I could have probably gotten to another 50 or 60 of them. But you know, I went out. I did a lot of as they say, the water bottle tour around LA, in the studios, meeting with different producers, meeting with different studios who are interested in the project. I had a book of artwork created for it. I mean, storyboards. We had an entire investment package created, a PPM, all the legal paperwork to start getting the ball rolling with it. I mean, I really went all out for it, guys. You know, I swung for the fences without question. I swung for the fences with Red Princess. And I'm very proud of how it ended up. I'm very proud of it. It's still one of my favorite things I've ever done in my life. It was so beautiful, and I was so happy with the way it turned out. Of course, we always want to change things, but that's the way all artists are, all directors are. You know, you want to go back and like, oh, I wish I could have done this or that. But, you know, we shot it in over 3 days. I think it was 2 days or 3 days. I don't even remember anymore. But it was pretty intense. And it was a lot of extras, a lot of wardrobe, a lot of everything. So what happened with the project? Well, a lot of dead ends. A lot of people wanted to be attached. You know, a lot of producers like, hey, let me go get money for it. It was set up. I optioned it a few times. Nothing ever came out of it, you know? So that's where a lot of, not only that project, but all the projects I've done in my career. That's why I'm a little cynical about how things work in Hollywood as a general statement, but, nothing really came out of it. So, you know, why did it cost $50,000? Well, the very first thing is I was trying to create a world. I was trying to do something that I hadn't seen before. And I was really trying to impress Hollywood, impress studios, impress producers or agents or managers. It was a point in my life where there was a desperation. It was a desperation in my work and in the way I carried myself. A lot of the things I preach against now on the podcast and on Indie Film Hustle, I was doing back then. So when I say not to do it, it's because I know what happens when you do it. And I was doing it for a long time. But, you know, I think one of the big mistakes that you make, and this is one of the top mistakes that I made on Red Princess, is trying to compete with a Hollywood production as far as production value is concerned. I was trying to create a 10-minute piece that had the same production value out of a 10-minute Hollywood blockbuster of $100 million, which is not really possible. It really isn't. Now, a lot of people are listening to like, well, how about District 9? I mean, they did this insane visual effects, huge production value, and there's multiple other shorts that came out that did things that are really high end to get noticed and to get their projects off the ground. Yes, that is exactly it. So District 9, I'm going to use as an example. If you have access to high end visual effects guys that really are insane, and you feel that you can create a world and can create a production value that's on par with a studio, great, do it. Okay. But my advice and my experience is don't, because yes, District 9 happened. How many District 9s have there been in the last 15, 20 years? Not many. And there's a reason for that, because and again, this is my opinion. When Hollywood looks at new talent, you know, the El Mariachi model of like, look at all that production value they got out of no money. Those days are gone. They really are. They're not there anymore, because production value is affordable now. You can get high production value. But now that bar is moved from the days of El Mariachi. You know, an action movie back in 92 is a lot different than an action movie now. Before, they were making $15, $20 million, $10 million action movies that were being released theatrically. Now they're not. Now they're making $100, $150 million action movies. You know, it's not on par anymore. But what has created a lot of stars, directors, writer-directors, who's created a lot of noise, has been with good short films that are story-based, character-based, vision-based. That's what Hollywood is looking for. They're looking for a unique voice. They're looking for someone who can direct story and character, someone who could tell a story and work with characters and actors and have a point of view, a vision, okay? A voice, a unique voice. Because this is the way Hollywood looks at things, guys. And this is, again, my opinion. They look at a guy like Chris Nolan, okay, who started off with a film called The Following. You look at the movie called Memento or Following, you don't think blockbuster. You don't think one of the biggest blockbuster directors of his generation. You don't think that. But what Chris was able to do, or Mr. Nolan, excuse me, I don't know him personally. What Chris Nolan was able to do was show people he can tell a story, that he can work with actors, that he had a unique point of view, a unique vision. That's what you need to focus on with short films. And guess what? Those kind of shorts or those kind of independent features are affordable. When you go after these bigger, big movie action style kind of films and you're trying to compete with Hollywood, you're not going to make it. And I'm the first to say never give up on a dream, never give up on trying to try something new, but understand that there is a risk when doing it at a big dollar value. Like I did, I rolled the dice with $50,000 of hard-earned money that I had created. And believe me, it wasn't like I had $500,000 in the bank. That was a lot of money, and it took a big chunk out of my savings out. Now, if you want to go and try to create high production value and really compete with the big boys on a feature-length film, you can. I'm going to have an amazing story coming up in the next few weeks of a filmmaker who just did that, a $250,000 budget that looked like a $20 to $30 million budget. And it really did, and how he did it. So it is possible. But with a feature, you have something you can sell. You have something that you can make money with. You can have an ROI. On shorts, it's very difficult to make a lot of money. It's unique if you can. So you can't invest a large amount of money in those kinds of short film projects unless you really feel that you're going to be able to make all of your money back. Lesson number one, focus on story. On how to tell a story, how to work with actors and create characters and a vision, a point of view, or a new voice. That's what Hollywood's looking for with short films, specifically if anything even happens with short films. I know many short films that, like The Raven, which is one I'll put a link to in the description. I read all these articles. Mark Wahlberg bought the script and all this stuff. Nothing's happened with it. That's happened 3-4 years ago. It's probably stuck in a hell somewhere. And I would love to know what happened with that project, because it was a great little project, had a lot of great, there was a commercial director who did it. He busted out all his friends, spent about $100,000 on it, and did a really nice job and really showed off what he could do. But nothing happened. Nothing happened with it. Not saying that there's anything wrong with that project, but it just didn't happen. It's just the way Hollywood works, guys. So, and I've seen so many of these shorts that are all high end. When I was doing this water bottle tour, these guys were showing me shorts in their rooms of other guys who were doing cool things. I was looking, I'm like, why haven't I even seen this before? Holy cow, look at that. Doesn't matter. It was rough. So guys, focus on story and telling a good story. The next mistake I made is I didn't know who I was going to do this, who I was aiming this to. Who was my audience? I didn't know who my audience was. You know, I really thought like, well, I'll just make it and make a whole bunch of noise and I'll do what I did with Broken and people will come. You know, if you build it, they will come. And it didn't work that way. So because I didn't understand who I was aiming this at, I kind of floundered. I didn't know where to do, because I made a very conscious effort not to redo what I did with Broken in the sense of creating a whole bunch of tutorials and put out another DVD and sell that. I decided, like, I'm not going to do that again in my high-end ego craziness that I was back then, where you're like, nah, I'm not going to do that. I've done that already. I've moved on from that. Well, believe me, in hindsight, I wish I would have done something like that, because then maybe we would have been able to bring back a little bit of dinero from, I would have maybe recouped some of my money, which I didn't. I did do one thing, and I did try to create a unique thing. I think I was the first short film to actually create an actual app on the iPhone and Android where you can buy the app for 99 cents or $1.99 or whatever it was and watch my short with a bunch of behind the scenes footage and other things that I put on it. I was a little bit ahead of my time, but I also don't think it was a wise thing, because I was after making the app and everything like that, I might have, if I was lucky, I might have pulled in $500, $1,000 if I'm lucky. And it cost me like $500 to make the damn app in the first place. So, you know, the self-distribution outlets were not there yet. This is 2010. So there wasn't Amazon Prime. There wasn't, you could put it on YouTube, but that was still very taboo to put a short film on YouTube back then if you're going to try to get into festivals and stuff like that. So it was a bunch of different things that were going on back then. So knowing who you want the short that you're making to go to is very important, especially when you're risking so much money. The next big mistake I made, and I didn't ask myself this question because I was just so gung-ho about putting it out there, was what's going to be my ROI? What's going to be my return on investment? You know, what I was really swinging for the fences on this, and I did basically everything I preach against. I had no real distribution plan. I had no real way of making money with it because I had no indie film hustle. There was nothing like that around. I had no audience. I had nothing I can sell. So basically I was just going to put it out in the festival market and hope that someone watches it and someone comes down from Mount Hollywood, taps me on the shoulder and says, "You shall direct. Here's a check for $5 million. Go make your movie and you're off to the races." And it did not work that way. And it does not work that way. That's why I yell so much about this when I talk about this subject. So I didn't ask myself that question. What's my return on investment? So I had no way of selling it. I had no way of making any money with it. And I had no way of guaranteeing that I even had a chance of making any money with it. So that was one of the biggest mistakes I made as a filmmaker, is I invested, as a businessman, I invested $50,000 in a product that I had no way of selling. I was just using it as a proof of concept. And $50,000 is a hell of an expensive proof of concept. If you're doing it for a grand or two, something that's really affordable in a smaller scale, then yes. And if you want to do that, by all means, you can do that. But on an investment like $50,000, you look at that now, a lot of you guys listening, like 50 grand, I can make 3 movies with 50 grand. I could have made a feature film with 50 grand. But at that time, technology wasn't caught up yet. And this new revolution, the DSLR revolution, hadn't hit yet, as far as making really affordable short independent films, things like that. So please always ask the question, what's going to be my return on investment? Where am I going to make money on this? How am I going to make money on this? Can I afford to lose all this money? Or am I going to swing for the fences? And you can do that. And a lot of people have done that with features. You know, they mortgage their house, for God's sakes. Listen to episode 88 if you're thinking about doing something like that. And I'll put that in the show notes as well. You know, or put it all on your credit cards, you know, and make a $50,000. And, you know, it's very romantic. But anyway, I don't want to get into that because I'll go off again. But, you know, at least I did it with my money and I didn't put it on credit and it didn't kill me. It was something that I could afford. It still hurt. So also, I wanted to go back real quick on the production of it and lessons I learned from making a $50,000 short film. Like, where did $50,000 go? That's the question. Where did 50 grand go if I got all this free stuff, people working for free, high-end people working for free, or really cheap? Where did all this go? I made the goddamn thing too big. It was an event. You walk on that set that I had. First of all, I had a soundstage that I had to rent out for a week. That wasn't cheap. I had to hire a producer. All the food. I must have had on set on any day probably 30 to 40 people, maybe even 50 people on a short film. So all of those people had to be fed. All of those people, a lot of those people were being paid. A lot of them were actors and extras. I had to deal with SAG and all the fees that I had to pay for it back then before all the rules changed. So it was a little bit tougher back then to deal with SAG. So the thing was that there was just so many people and each of those departments needed a bunch of different things. And if you watch the short film, you'll understand like, oh, okay, there's a lot of stuff going on, you know? And that's with a lot of free stuff, you know? I had a lot of favors I pulled to get it done, but it was just so big. I had a really good production team for the most part. There were issues. There were people that I wish I would have not hired on my team because, you know, I wasn't working with a lot of people that I knew, and had only been in LA for basically a couple years at that point. So I didn't have the depth of connections and relationships that I do now, let's say, because I hadn't worked as much as I had at that point. So I was still, you know, kind of green, and I was definitely green working with a full blown Hollywood set, you know, full blown Hollywood set with really high end people that are expected to do certain things. So I felt that the whole short got a little bit away from me back then. And we're talking about now 8 years ago, almost 7-8 years ago. And I learned a lot about how I wanted to run a set, how I wanted to control my vision and make sure that the vision that I have is gets onto that screen. So I had to fight on set with people's egos and stuff like that, which I was not aware of. It wasn't any of my actors, by the way. All my actors were wonderful. I'm talking about people behind the scenes. And it could be the smallest thing. It could have been the biggest thing. But because I felt like this was all out of control for me, I think that's where a lot of this money went. When you do a project at this size, there's a money hose. And all of a sudden, when you crack that money hose open, it just keeps flowing. It keeps flowing. It keeps flowing. And it's like opening up a brand new business, which I have a little experience about, as you guys all know, with my gourmet shop. It was very similar to opening up our store. Like the second you open it, every day there's something new. Every day you need to put more money in here. And oh, I didn't know that, or I didn't know that. And, you know, oh, this department needs this now, and this department needs that now, and we need this permit now, and we need this insurance now. And, you know, we did a lot of things that I wish we wouldn't have done. But I felt that it was a little out of control. And once that train left the station, it was very difficult for me to control it. So that's just an experience. And running with a $50,000 budget when you were that inexperienced is something I think was a bit foolish on my part. Now, with all of that said, those were the big mistakes I felt. Trying to compete with Hollywood production, you know, values, not focusing on story and vision as much. I didn't understand who I was really focused, how I was going to be able to make money with this, and who I was focusing, what my audience was going to do, and what my ROI, what my return on investment was going to be, and having a distribution plan at all. That's why I always yell, festivals are not a distribution plan. You have to actually have one. So what good things came out of Red Princess, and where is Red Princess today? Well, a lot of good things came out of Red Princess. I was able to do a lot of festivals, made a lot of connections. I was on panels with big stars, big Hollywood stars, made connections with them. Had the experience of doing a lot of LA film festivals. I mean, it was literally every other week I was on a red carpet with this film. It was very well received, and people really do enjoy it and really liked it, which is great. And it did add a level of legitimacy to myself as a director. And that little short did get me jobs. So I think probably from all the jobs I've gotten based off of that short, I was able to probably recoup my money at least just from the jobs that I was getting as a director, as a commercial director, music video director, and things like that based off the quality that I was able to create with that. So on that sense, it was a very big success. I've been able to, if you guys are part of the syndicate, you've probably seen the short film that I'm talking, both short films I'm talking about, because they're part are of the syndicate, part of the filmmaking hacks course that I have, where I talk a little bit about my experiences making the film. We'll go a little bit behind the scenes of how we did some things. I did do some behind the scenes, but nothing compared to what I did on Broken, or the depth of the tutorials that I was able to do back then. And I, by the way, I still have probably about 10 to 15 hours of behind the scenes footage. Maybe one day I'll go into it and start creating some tutorials on how we did some of the cool stuff that we did back then. But I'm busy right now, as you can imagine. So many of the lessons I learned on Red Princess, I brought to This Is Meg. And This Is Meg is the complete opposite of what I did with Red Princess. You know, it's a feature, first of all, is not a short. It was very controllable. I kept it really small, very small crew, and focused on story, focused on character, focused on vision of what I wanted to try to do and the kind of story I was trying to tell as a director. And the risk is very minimal comparatively to, you know, 50 grand or 60 grand on a short film. Let me go back. Of course, obviously, This Is Meg was made for under $25 million. And I released the budget once my IRS audit is done. But it was done on a humble budget, to say the least. But again, so I do believe that Red Princess Blues was a amazing experience for me as a filmmaker. And I think, you know, I wouldn't want you guys to have to go through that and lose 50 grand and then wait years to hopefully get jobs to get yourself paid back. That's not a business plan. But I'm very happy that I went through that. And I'm very happy that of the lessons I learned from it, because it made me a much, much, much better director. And I'm very proud of it and very proud of what we were able to do with it. Now, where is it today? Well, my screenplay is still available. And I love that screenplay. I love what I did with it. It has been read a bunch. I haven't really pushed it too much. I might start pushing it a little bit more in the next coming months, once I start getting a little bit of attention from This Is Meg, hopefully. And I'll have something else in my back pocket, you know, to show people at meetings. And go, oh, by the way, I also did this short. So I think the story of Red Princess Blues and where it's going to take me as a filmmaker and a storyteller is still being written. But I wanted to share this experience with you guys, because I know a lot of people out there are thinking maybe of doing a big swing for the fences kind of short film. And I just wanted to show you guys my experience and tell you guys my experience of what I went through doing something like that. The bottom line is, guys, that you got to keep working. And, you know, if I would do this all over again today, I would take that 50 grand and make a feature film without question, without question. In today's world, there's no reason, absolutely no reason, you would spend $50,000 on a short film unless you're trying to do exactly what I told you not to do, which is to create a world, create the same kind of production value that you're trying to compete with on a Hollywood budget film to try to get those jobs. If you're trying to get those jobs, my suggestion is follow what all the other really well-known directors who have gotten noticed, the Darren Aronofskys with Pi, Chris Nolan with The Following and Memento. These guys focused on story, not big blockbuster films. Hollywood figures that they can't hire a great team around a visionary director, because the technical stuff can be, you can hire technical. It's hard to hire vision. It's hard to hire someone with a voice. That's something you can't buy as easily as a very competent creative crew. So understand that. And next time you're going to try to make a short film, a feature film, to try to get attention, or to even get your name out there into the world, guys. And if you want to go deeper into my trials and tribulations with Red Princess Blues, there's an entire chapter dedicated to it in Rise of the Filmtrepreneur. And if you want to listen to two free chapters of Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, just go to filmtrepreneur.com/024. I released the first two chapters of the book in this podcast. So enjoy, guys. And of course, if you want to purchase the book, just go to filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And if you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to filmtrepreneur.com/050, where you will get links to Red Princess Blues and Red Princess Blues Genesis, the animated prequel that I did as well, which you can both watch the trailers and some behind the scenes stuff that I did with it. But if you want to watch both shorts, you can watch that at indiefilmhustle.tv. I hope you got something out of this episode, guys. And I plan to make 50 or 500 more episodes of great content that can help you on your filmtrepreneurial journey. And in today's world that we're in right now, in the COVID-19 world, this is more important than ever before. The filmtrepreneur method is more important than ever before to survive in these new uncertain times. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, be a filmtrepreneur. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Filmtrepreneur podcast at filmtrepreneur.com.